You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
This is A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And our guest today is again Philip Goldberg. Philip was with us last week, and he is back with us today for more conversation about karma and his new book, Karmic Relief: Harnessing the Laws of Cause and Effect for a Joyful, Meaningful Life. Philip is a public speaker, meditation teacher, and ordained interfaith minister, and he hosts the Spirit Matters podcast and posts frequently on Substack. Philip has been studying the spiritual traditions of India for nearly 50 years as a practitioner, teacher, and writer. He was a transcendental meditation teacher in the 1970s and helped start Maharishi International University. He has written numerous books, including a biography on the life of Paramahansa Yogananda and the award-winning American Veda and Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times. Philip Goldberg, welcome back to A Better World.
Thank you, McNair. Good to be back with you.
Thank you for coming back again.
I have to update your bio. It's now more than 50 years.
Okay. Well, next time, after your next book, would you come back
on?
Okay. Do you mind if we start by my asking you about something you said, which is indirectly related to the book Karmic Relief? And it was a quote that I came across by you where you said that the primary trends in American religion and spirituality over the past few decades are really related to our growing access to the Indian traditions, Buddhism, and Vedantic and yogic aspects of Hinduism. What is it about those traditions, speaking generally, that attracts people over the traditions like Christianity, Judaism, and Islam that are found in the West?
A scholar of religion once said, the religion of America is the religion of no religion. So Americans have always had an independent streak. And if you look at the Christianity of early America, there were breakaways from what we were then the mainstream of Christian groups. We've always welcomed diversity. At the same time, there were always people who fought against diversity, so there were always two kinds of Americans. But if I had to speak generally about that, what I found in researching American Veda is going back as far as the early and mid-19th century, when access to the sacred literature of the East, books on Buddhism and Hinduism, articles, the first translation of the Bhagavad Gita, things like that, attracted free-thinking Americans, most notably Ralph Waldo Emerson and his fellow transcendentalists. They had a certain appeal, and people then absorbed those teachings, integrated them into their own lives, and in many cases, as with Whitman and Thoreau and Emerson, conveyed those ideas to others, which is one of the ways it spread. What appeals mostly, I think, is the non-dogmatic aspect of it. Those traditions are not proselytizing traditions in the way the Western traditions are. They don't emphasize belief. Of course, there are beliefs, there are ideas, there are precepts, but they're presented, at least the more modern versions, as insights and revelations that can be tested, that can be verified in your own experience, that should be put to the test of reason and logic and so forth. So those teachings never seem to be in conflict with science or with history as we know it. That's one reason. But the other reason is the emphasis on experience. All the teachings, all the precepts will always say, as the Buddhists put it, the teachings, the ideas, are the fingers pointing to the moon. You have to see the moon directly. And that means having inner experiences of union with the divine, what Aldous Huxley called the unitive mystical experience. And they have a repertoire of practices to facilitate that inner experience and the transformation, the personal transformation that results from inner experience. That's why we've adopted yoga. That's why meditation is now recommended by your doctor and your psychotherapist. But all of these things started as part of a sacred tradition, mindfulness in the Buddhist context. They're sacred traditions meant to bring about the unity, which is the definition of yoga, of the individual and something bigger, something sacred, something divine, something without boundaries that's universal, that in the West might be called God. So it's a combination of compatibility with reason. That alone wouldn't suffice. They have to be appealing ideas that have to appeal to people. And the emphasis on experience along with methods to facilitate that experience. Americans are very pragmatic, or certainly the Americans drawn to these things are very pragmatic. Oh, you have something to offer? Well, let's see if it works. And that's what they brought to the table. And if you look at the trends in religious and spiritual surveys over the last 30, 40 years, this whole phenomenon, for example, of people being spiritual but not religious, there are always people like that. I always say Emerson was the founding father of spiritual but not religious. But there are more and more and more of them, and there wouldn't have been more and more and more of them if there weren't alternatives and if to the conventional religions, and if there weren't methods, so somebody could have a deep spiritual life without necessarily affiliating with a mainstream religious institution.
And I hear that more and more all the time, you know, oh, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual.
Well, you live in Asheville.
Yeah.
And you would get, there are a lot of refugees from religions and spiritual cults in Asheville, I know.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So I pardon me if I'm getting too deep in the weeds, but I wanted to ask you, I understand that you are interested in, influenced by Vedanta. Mm. Is Vedanta, is it a branch of Hinduism?
Could say that. There are different schools of philosophy or metaphysics or theology, whatever you want to call it, in the Indian tradition or the Hindu tradition. And Vedanta is one of them, and it's the dominant one. It's the most widespread, the most fabric of Indian life is very Vedantic and very yogic. Yoga is considered one of the six systems of Indian philosophy. Vedanta is another. People like to make distinctions, but in reality, most Indians with an active spiritual life, most gurus and swamis, especially the ones that come to the West, combine Vedantic ideas and the methods of yoga as needed, as doing what works. So yes, Vedanta, and there are schools within Vedanta. It's not all that uniform, but there are certain characteristics, namely this understanding of oneness, of unity, of the cosmos, of the individual and the cosmos, and so, that sort of thing. So that's what distinguishes Vedanta. Vedanta means the end of the culmination of the Vedas. So if anybody's curious, well, anybody's curious can just Google the term. But if you've read the Bhagavad Gita or any of the Upanishads, those are considered the articulation of Vedanta philosophy.
Does your book, American Veda, go into that aspect of Hinduism, like Vedanta?
Everything I've said so far is essentially a synopsis of American Veda. Most of the book is recounting or chronicling this long history and the ways these Eastern teachings, and I didn't include much of Buddhism because there were histories of that. So it's mostly how Vedanta and yoga, the ideas and practices entered American life, the various streams that brought it into the heart of American culture, the different ways it's been adapted in different areas of our lives, the different people who made it possible, some of whom, you know, are very familiar to everybody. Certainly the Beatles are.
I said in the introduction that earlier in your life, you taught transcendental meditation, helped start Maharishi International University. And I read in one interview with you that you still meditate daily.
Yeah, I do.
From the angle of Hinduism, Vedanta, can you kind of point us to an understanding of what is the purpose of meditation?
Like a lot of other useful things, it could have be put to many uses. Yoga is meant to bring about the state of unity, consciousness, to raise consciousness. Some people just do physical yoga to feel better or lose weight. And same is true of meditation. When I took it up, on the heels of the Beatles making it a household word, it was to expand consciousness. You know, the early adopters in those days were mostly people who wanted an inner spiritual experience. And in my era, during the counterculture of the 60s and the Beatles, there was a lot of experimentation with psychoactive drugs to expand consciousness and bring about mystical experience. And meditation came along, and many of us saw it as a safer, more reliable alternative with centuries-old pedigree. And it worked. People tried it. It worked. As a result of that, grown-ups, because most of us were young, said, "Why? What's going on here? Why are these kids adopting this heebie-jeebie stuff from India and running off to see gurus and stuff?" It didn't start then, but it exploded then. It had been building for many years. Yogin, you mentioned my book on Yogananda. He came in 1920, and there were, you know, he transformed the lives of many people. But then suddenly the 60s and mass media and everything, things exploded. So, but then people did research and said, is anything really going on when these kids meditate, or are they just calming down a little? Is it a placebo? What's going on? And they did experiments on the things that can be measured. And what can be measured is what goes on in your body. So, oh yeah, look, it lowers blood pressure. It changes your brain waves. It brings about these changes. Let's use it for medical purposes. And maybe it'll reduce anxiety and depression so people don't need Valium or whatever. And that, so it transitioned in less than a decade into medicine and psychotherapy and all that. And now, you know, your health provider might pay for you to take yoga classes or learn to meditate and so forth. So it gets adapted to different people's needs. Even in the 70s, when I was a teacher of it, we were showing scientific charts from scientific studies. And, you know, people who had no interest in spirituality or consciousness, they said, oh, well, you know, I have high blood pressure, you know, sold. And and so, you know, that's so it, there's multi-layered purposes to many things, you know, like technologies are used for different things. So if you think of these methods of yoga and meditation and mindfulness and all that as sort of introspective technologies or non-machine technologies, people have the same attitude and they'll have different, they'll take adoptive for different reasons, but they begin, they began, they show up in the Upanishads and all the ancient literature as methods of achieving spiritual experience.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Philip Goldberg. He's with us again this week, and we are having a conversation about karma and his new book, Karmic Relief, Harnessing the Laws of Cause and Effect for a Joyful, Meaningful Life. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org.
And though we grew up on the right side of the track, he's gone too far, now he can't get back. No mercy on the criminal. Hard times come to those who steal. Loves the danger, likes to watch the young girls cry. Left home in anger and never stopped to say goodbye.
Okay, that's the Marshall Tucker Band singing No Mercy from their album Southern Spirit. Philip, let's go to the book at this point. I was wondering, if you don't mind, for those listeners who may not have heard last week's show, can you give us a bird's eye view or a summary of your book, Karmic Relief?
Well, I think most people are familiar with the word karma now. I don't remember if we discussed this last time, but the word karma essentially means action. That's the Sanskrit, a translation from the Sanskrit. The larger meaning, including, you know, the laws of karma operant in the universe, are essentially a model of cause and effect, that every action, to use the term in the third law of thermodynamics and physics, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So if you apply that to human behavior and think of everything we do, and not just do, but everything we say, and really everything we think, every event that goes on in human life reverberates outward and has consequences, creates effect. They're the causes of effects. And they come back to us in one form or another at some time or another. And so when people talk about karma, they usually revert to the Western aphorism for it from the Bible, that we reap what we sow. Or they'll say, what goes around comes around. Or as Willie Nelson put it in his song, Old Fashioned Karma, a little bit of sowing, a little bit of reaping, a little bit of laughing, a little bit of weeping. Things come around. Yeah. And so that's what we mean by karma, that there's a laws of cause and effect in the universe, and they apply to our lives. So everything that's going on now is the result of past actions. Everything we do now, everything we say, will reverberate and have consequences that we will experience as either good or bad or indifferent or desirable and undesirable and so forth. That's the basic law. So why write a book about it? If that was your question, I can't quite remember. Because I've noticed over the years, you know, as a kind of literary historian of this phenomenon of Eastern ideas coming to America and becoming part of the worldview of people, karma was a great example of it. And it just kept happening more and more. It would show up in sitcoms and song lyrics, as I suggested. And so I noticed that, and I thought, well, what purpose is it serving? Why is that happening? And I also noticed it was misunderstood and misused and misapplied a lot, or, you know, kind of incompletely understood. So I started doing research. And a few years ago, when Taylor Swift cut a record called Karma, I said, okay, that's it. I should write a book about it. And that was my intention, to clarify misunderstandings and help readers deal with the unwanted karma that comes our way and live a life that creates better karma going forward, not just for ourselves, but for, you know, those we care about, mm-hmm. and our communities, mm-hmm. and so forth.
When I was preparing for the show, I read about a poll, I think it was taken in 2024, that it was a poll of 2,000 adults, I believe, that indicated 84% of Americans subscribe to the idea of karma, that what you put out into the world comes back to you. And another 84% said they actively try to pay it forward with acts of kindness whenever they can. Would certainly seem to indicate the idea of karma has taken hold, doesn't it?
Yes. And, you know, to be honest, to be fair, it's not that a great number of those people would not even be using the term karma. Mm-hmm. They would because there's ways of understanding Western religion in much the same way. And this notion that if you do good, it's more blessed to give than receive. Why is it a blessing to give? Because it comes back to you in some way. So, you know, people who are raised in an ethical household, whether it's secular or religion, or, you know, are lucky to go to a church or synagogue or mosque where a message of generosity of spirit and kindness is advocated, and it's understood that you will be rewarded for this in one way or another, they will ascribe to what you said, even if they don't know the word karma. That said, many people reject, you know, the teachings of whatever tradition they were born into and find karma and everything associated with it from the East to be more compatible with how they see the world.
You talked earlier about Yogananda bringing the idea of meditation back in the early part of the 20th century. And you, in your book, you also mentioned another spiritual teacher from India, Vivekananda, who was instrumental in helping to bring this idea of karma to the West. And I wanted to ask you about, I think he wrote a book called Karma Yoga. What does that mean, Karma Yoga, and what's that book about?
Let me first say, Vivekananda preceded Yogananda by a generation. If you know India, they both grew up in the same part of Calcutta, and they both went to the same college. And Yogananda would have been inspired by Vivekananda's example, his sort of triumph in America made him a national hero. So he came here in 1893, and he was not here very long. He didn't live very long. He died in 1902. And his legacy, which continues to this day, was furthered and has endured because of the institutions he created and the legacy of the written word that he left behind. In that category were four books on the four different types of yoga or styles of yogic pathways. We don't have to go into all of them. We can if you wish, but one of them is Karma Yoga. And so one of those four books is Karma Yoga. They're all given a chapter in the Bhagavad Gita, as it happens. And not Vivekananda's version. The Gita precedes him by many, many centuries. But Karma Yoga is essentially the karma of action. We said karma means action. Karma Yoga is the path to union with the divine through action. What kind of action? Selfless action, ego-free action. So somebody dedicated to the path of Karma Yoga would be an action-oriented person who wants to accomplish something in the outer world and would be directed to doing good for others, for the community, and so forth. Acts of service, acts of charity, acts that are performed, even if it's whatever action it is, running your business, whatever. Action performed without regard for personal reward or consequence, which doesn't mean you don't care. It means you do the work with a sense of non-attachment to the outcome, and you do the work as ego-free as possible. That's essentially the path of Karma Yoga.
You talk in the book about how, quote, karmic waves, unquote, are on the way for us, and that there isn't anything that can be done to stop them. Well, maybe there isn't a way to stop it, but is there a way to prepare for it when it does hit?
Very good. And strictly speaking, we can affect the waves. The other metaphor I use is that everything we do and say and so forth goes out into the universe with a self-addressed stamped envelope. It's going to come back to us at some point in some way, but we don't know what the content of the envelope will be. But if you take the laws of karma seriously, we can change the content of the envelope by subsequent actions. So say somebody does something wrong. That's going to come back at some point. But if a person grows in consciousness and sees the mistake that he or she made, they can do good things. It's one of the reasons the 12-step programs are so effective. The imperative in there to make amends is a way of modifying your karma. You did someone wrong, you make amends. Well, then when it comes back, it won't be as painful. The preparation part is a very good insight of yours. Metaphorically, if you take out a loan and that loan comes with a due date, you have to make a payment at some point. Okay, with respect to karma, you don't know the date, but it's going to come due. If you waste that money from the loan, if you misuse it, if you don't spend it wisely, and you're broke when the loan comes due, that's going to be painful. That's going to hurt. But if you use the loan wisely and invest it well, whatever purpose it serves, and you have a healthy bank account when the loan comes due, it's a minor obligation, and it's not going to be painful. It will have been ameliorated by your subsequent actions. That's a way of preparing for our karma. We do stuff that we regret, we grow, we learn, and then we start adding good karma to our bank account, our karmic account, so that when the negative stuff becomes due, we have a cushion of good karma to counterbalance it. And that's where growth and learning come in. And most of the gurus and swamis who discuss karma talk about it not as a system of rewards and punishments, but as merely causes and effects that are meant to teach us.
Is that related to the idea that I've often read about, that the more we grow spiritually towards what's known in some circles as self-realization or God-realization, that when we reach that state, we're not really bothered by the karma when it does unfold?
Yes. That's held to be what we call self-realization or enlightenment or full awakening. That state of awareness, if it's real, is presented as, among other things, a state of contentment and fulfillment that's beyond the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. The Bhagavad Gita has a term, a phrase that's called equanimity, having equanimity in gain and loss, victory and defeat, pleasure and pain. So it's beyond the and unaffected by the events of our lives and by the dualities of good and bad and so forth. It's just a state of contentment so strong that whatever happens, it's unshakable. To the extent we grow toward that, then we exhibit that in our lives. And people who are on a spiritual path for a number of years will have glimpses of that. They'll tell you, oh yeah, I still get angry, I still get upset, I still have pain, but it's not what it used to be. There's something inside that can withstand all that stuff better than I did in the past, and I recover from the upheavals much more quickly. That there's actually scientific evidence that that's the case with practices like meditation and mindfulness and so forth. So if you project that to some level of attainment that's described as self-realization and so forth, that's the case. Because there's a part of us, our deepest core, and this is pure Vedanta, and one of the reasons, to go back to your first question, why it is so appealing to us in the West, that there is, you know, what we are at our deepest level, at our core, transcends our personalities, the character traits, the body. It's one with the divine nature of the cosmos, or the ground of being, to use secular terms. And that's beyond karma. It's beyond ups and downs and ins and outs and good and bad and pleasure and pain. So the extent to which we bring that quality into our individual lives and are aware of it, there's a part of us that transcends karma.
Our guest today on A Better World is Philip Goldberg. He's author of the book, Karmic Relief. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we'll return with Philip in just a few minutes after this break.
A butterfly lands on me shoulder. I'm surprised to see her so close to me. I look up to the horizon. I see the endless beauty of my blue seas. I hear the whisper of the gentle sea breeze. And it seems almost perfect. But deep down I'm silently hurting. crisis makes to me. Why does it seem like no one is listening? Why are they all consumed by greed? What will it take to get them to hear me? What would it take to get them to believe? Climate change and global warming. My island will be sinking. One by one throughout all the seas. Can they realize they are not just destroying me? The butterfly leaves my shoulder. I see her fly away far, far away. She disappears into the sunlight. And I know the arming of a butterfly effect. What goes around will come around. And the whole world will realize their demise. I close my eyes and take a deep breath. And leave the beach with me. Yeah. Why does it seem like why no one is listening? Why are they all consumed by me? Yeah. What will it take to why get them to kill me? What would it take to tell get them to know? Climate change and global warming. My island will be sinking. One by one throughout all the seas. Can they realize they are not just destroying me? Different languages, but the language of Mother Nature is universal. We all must be responsible, even if we want to or not, because the hard truth is, we have no choice, it's a race against time, and we have to do something right now, or you will finally feel it, finally regret, the karma of the butterfly you fade. Why does it seem like no one is listening?
Okay, welcome back. That song is Karma of the Butterfly Effect by Ja Boy, and that's from the album Green Project. And our guest today is Philip Goldberg, author of the book Karmic Relief, and he's back with us again. He was with us last week, and we are doing part two of an interview with him today. We were talking before the break about the idea of self-realization and the effect that that can have on dealing with one's karma. Does that progression towards spiritual awareness and growth, does that connect to the idea that you talk about in the book about acceptance? You seem to indicate in the book is important for a way to deal with karma or whatever comes back to us.
The unwanted parts, especially. In thinking, when people talk about karma, they usually are talking about the bad stuff. And I have to always remind people that all the good stuff is karma, too. Everything is an effect of causation in the past. So one of the things people have to deal with is unexpected disruptions, eruptions, you could say, of pain, discomfort, disappointment, all the stuff we have to deal with in life. That's the result of karma accrued in the past. So how do you deal with that and from a karmic perspective? And one of the things I learned in doing my research is accepting what is, you know, that expression, it is what it is. Okay. It's a cliche, but it is what it is. And this is what life has put before us. And if you take karma seriously, you have to say there's no reason to feel self-pity. There's no reason to rend your garment in, you know, regret and recrimination. There's no reason to look for something to blame or someone to blame. It is what it is. This is the delivery. It's on your doorstep. You open the box. It's here. What do you do? If you accept, and by accept doesn't mean you approve of it. You'd rather not have it, but here it is. And if you accept that and then say, what do I do? That is a pragmatic way to deal with the undesirable karma that comes our way. What can I learn from this? What can I do to ameliorate it? What can I do to create better karma going forward? How can I help myself and whoever else is involved? It's a pragmatic choice to just say, okay, this is real, this is here. Accept it with as much of a non-judgmental attitude as you can, and then take pragmatic steps. How does it relate to self-realization? Well, it would seem to me the more self-realized we are, the easier it is to accept. When we're caught up in desires and in discontent and needs and so forth, then when something negative arises, it's all magnified. But if we have a certain level of inner stability, equanimity, as I said before, inner peace, clarity of mind, when something bad happens, we are much more likely to be able to say, this is what it is, what can I do? So there's a relationship between inner spiritual development or growth and our capacity for dealing with karma.
I've read some books by devotees of spiritual teachers who say that their teacher, their guru, led them to self-realization and then freed them from having to reap their karma. But is this possible? I mean, if karma is an immutable law, which you seem to be saying, maybe I'm reading into it, wouldn't such a teacher have to live within that law? I read something from Madame Blavatsky, who was the founder of Theosophy, and she wrote, "No adept of the right path will interfere with the just workings of karma. Not even the greatest of yogis can divert the progress of karma or arrest the natural results," and so on, etc. And she goes on to say, "These results will only reassert themselves later with even tenfold force, for such is the law of karma."
Yeah, I don't know about the tenfold force. There's different.
It's scary to think about.
Yeah, there's different interpretations of karma and so forth. But my first thought is, beware of anybody who says he's beyond or above the laws of karma. And to be perfectly frank, a lot of abuse and exploitation has occurred when people take that literally and attribute it to a spiritual teacher, and especially those who advertise that kind of capacity, because you can get away with a lot if you claim to be above the laws of karma and claim that whatever you do is divinely inspired and so forth. You're right to question that. There are, Yogananda is one of them, and I have the highest regard for him, there are methods, it is said, by which enlightened spiritual teachers, gurus, can ameliorate the effects of karma, of their disciples' karma, take on their karma, it is said. That's above my pay grade. That may or may not be possible. And maybe it is. And some people have said that's what Jesus meant. Or, when people attribute it to him, taking on the sins of others, they may have been meant in the, as a karmic thing. That aside, as long as we are embodied, your body is still in whatever's going on in your consciousness, your body is still subject to aging and illness and the effects of past behavior. One's consciousness may be unaffected. And that's often, in an abstract sense, what is meant by being beyond the laws of karma, because you're awake to that part of you that is beyond the laws of karma. But you're still in a body and you still have a personality. And your personality is still what it was, or similar to what it was before. And you're still subject to what you've learned before and what you've done before. Ramana Maharshi, or he was a great and presumably enlightened master. He had cancer at the end. his body was in pain. He would say, what he really is beyond all that. But the body was in pain, and the body died, and the body spoke, and the body, may have had different moods. So in that sense, somebody who thinks his guru or her guru freed them from karma and could be, and I don't want to make generalization, maybe it's real, maybe it's wishful thinking and a way to get away with doing stuff you think you won't have to pay for, to be a little cynical about it.
If you just joined us again, we are talking to Philip Goldberg. He's author of the book, Karmic Relief, Harnessing the Laws of Cause and Effect for a Joyful, Meaningful Life. And you're listening to us at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. We're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. Okay, that's Tears for Fears from their album Saturnine, Marshall, and Lunatic. And the song is Lord of Karma. Lots of songs out there with the word karma in it, so the idea must be ubiquitous in the music industry as well.
When I was researching Karmic Relief, I did a search on iTunes, and there were about 150. I just went for the ones I mentioned in the book, the ones by famous people like John Lennon and Taylor Swift and a few others, Alicia Keys. But you've now introduced me to some that I probably saw and didn't bother listening to.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, one of the things I've often read about is the idea that we create karma with people, say, that we know or love or in some type of relationship with. And if this is true, do we at some point have to work out that karma with the same person? If not in this life, then some future life? I guess another way to put it is, does karma tie us to particular people?
That's a great question, McNair. Logically speaking, you would say yes, but if you stretch it out over lifetimes, as if you accept reincarnation as part of the package that we understand karma playing out over long stretches of time, that soul would be in a different personality, different body. But it's kind of part of the discussions of karma, the discourses on karma, that our relationships reflect karmic relationships from the past. So you may have been part of, your sibling in this lifetime may have been a sibling in the past. Maybe you were older then and now you're younger. Maybe your parent was somebody of importance in a previous life. But certainly within this life, our behavior with others creates karmic resonance between us. We do something with our friend, we harm somebody, we help somebody, that will come back, but it may not necessarily come back with that person. It may be somebody else. The answer, I think the only way to answer your question is to say yes and no. Mm-hmm. It's certainly logical that it would. We have karma with certain people from the past. But it's also true that karma is mysterious and plays out in myriad mm-hmm. ways. And so we may do something to a close person, you know, when we're 20 and never see that person again, but that the effect of what we did will come back in a different way with somebody else. Mm-hmm. So the combinations, the possibilities are infinite. And it's one of the reasons, and I'm sure we discussed this last time, that karma, the playing out of karma, is considered unfathomable. The details mm-hmm. are unfathomable. Cause and effect is going on all the time. And the karma we bring into being is affected by the karma of those we come in contact with. And those waves interact and interact and interact and come back and reverberate in ways we can't predict mm-hmm. or can't trace back to some mm-hmm. individual cause.
When I read the chapter in your book called Don't Do the Wrong Thing, it made me think of the idea of harmlessness. Just be harmless to others, that this is at least a step in the right direction. Does this in and of itself get us where we want to go in terms of having good karma, or do we have to be proactive in being kind and good?
Well, in the yoga tradition, there are what's called yamas and niyamas. And one of the first mentioned is ahimsa, which we became familiar with because of Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi. And we think it means nonviolence, and it does, but it really means do no harm. Don't harm others. Don't cause others pain. To me, everything, as you suggest, all the codes of ethics, all the do's and don'ts, are subsets of do no harm. So if we can go through life with that as a guiding principle, we could do very well. If we need more details, then be kind, be generous, don't lie, tell the truth. You know, all the verities and virtues come into effect. And of course, it gets complicated, but do no harm. You can't do much better than that. And it's one of the reasons if you look at the golden rule, which shows up in one form or another in every spiritual tradition, you don't want that done to you, don't do it to others. That's a good guiding principle. And one wonders, since that's in every spiritual tradition, why it's not universally followed.
Like I said last week, we're slow learners.
Yeah, we are. And we pay the consequences.
Are accidents possible without relation to karma? Say an automobile accident, plane crash, people affected by the weather?
Yeah, there are different schools of thought on this. You know, certainly, some of this is unknowable. Mm-hmm. So there are different scholars and yogis and so forth who will have different opinions on this. Some will say what we call acts of God, hurricanes and floods and whatever, car accidents, things happen to people, and we can't always say it's a result of something they did. And there are people who will say, no, there's things going on in nature and in the world that affect our karma, but we can't say we caused it. We didn't cause the hurricane. We didn't cause the people who lost lives and properties in the fires in LA last year. They didn't cause the fire, but their karma put them in that place at that time when that happened. And so all the sunny days in that part of Los Angeles, they enjoyed the benefits of the karma that put them in that time and place. The fires, they had to endure the fire. I took a tour just a couple of weeks ago when I was in LA. Someone drove me around the fire devastated areas. Ruins, multi-million dollar homes, more modest homes, rubble, and some standing. Why? Was it the good karma of the people whose house survived and the bad karma of those who didn't? Who can say? I mean, that's beyond our comprehension. But there are those differences. But the agreement seems to be our actions brought us to a certain place in time and space. And then stuff may happen that is way beyond our individual cause and effect karma. But we will experience it each in our own way according to our karma and what we do about it. So somebody in that fire may have been brave enough to help other people escape or to get a hose and hose down, you know, a building. And that kind of heroic action is creating karma that will accrue in the future. Somebody else may have done something selfish and, you know, sped past people who needed a ride out of, you know, to escape, and they will have the karma of that decision. So it's nuanced, and one of the things we don't want to get sucked into is saying that when mass catastrophes happen, those people caused it, the people who suffer from it. That would be a cruel and inappropriate interpretation of karma.
Yeah, we talked about that in the first interview, that karma, if we think even if we knew something was karmic, it doesn't absolve us of the need or responsibility to try and help.
Yes, because that decision, if you see somebody, you're walking in the street and somebody trips and falls, you don't say, well, it's their karma, and step over them and keep walking. Because what kind of karma does that create? It's not an excuse for being indifferent or callous.
Just got a few minutes left. Do you have any more book projects in store for the future?
Should I live long enough to complete them? Yes. I've been actually working on a novel for a few years when I have the time. And that's my labor of love, and that I hope will be my next publication. But working on a novel that is deeply meaningful to me personally, because it's semi-autobiographical, and it's, you could say, it's my karma to get this done and get it out there. And if the laws of karma are cooperative, I will see it published.
Very good. Well, I want to thank Philip Goldberg for coming back this week and being with us again to talk more about his book, Karmic Relief, and topics related to that book. And then the book is Karmic Relief, Harnessing the Laws of Cause and Effect for a Joyful, Meaningful Life. Philip, thank you so much for being with us. And again, all the best with the book.
Thank you so much, McNair. I really appreciate it. And I want to say, I've been interviewed by a lot of people, and I commend you for, you know, being prepared and asking penetrating questions. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
It's just a little old-fashioned karma coming down. Just a little old-fashioned justice going round. A little bit of soul.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with a song called Little Old Fashioned Karma with Willie Nelson from the album Tougher Than Leather.
old-fashioned karma coming down. A little old-fashioned justice going round. A little bit of sowing and a little bit of reaping. A little bit of laughing and a little bit of weeping. Just a little old-fashioned karma coming down. Coming down, coming down. It's just a little old-fashioned karma coming down.